following program.
Now available stereophonic sound.
I was looking around for somewhere exciting to record the next album. So what I did, I thought a good idea would be to get a list off EMI, or record company, of all the studios they had around the world. It turned out they had one in Africa. We just said, yeah, let's go to Africa. The night before we were due to go, Denny and Henry rang up and said, we're not coming. We're not coming to Africa. We don't want to come. We're leaving the band. So, oh, great, thank you. At first it was like, oh no, tragedy. But then, you know, I just sort of thought, right, we're going to go and we're going to show you, we're going to make the best album we've ever made.
Chin's up, boobs out, it's showtime.
Time for music.
A civilized conversation.
Wherever the music takes me, kitten.
Scott Edward Phelps.
Ah, yes, the legendary wit, or at least half of it.
Dave Simmons.
Good evening, Dave.
Can we not talk about sex so much?
Tell you right out, I'm a man who likes talking to a man who likes to...
The most important music show ever.
Cue inspirational music.
The Audiophiles.
The song was inspired by a Land Rover. It went top 10 in America and top 15 in the UK over there where they talk funny down in January 1974. It was included on the American release of the originally recorded British album that became that album that Sir James Paul McCartney was determined to make the best album he had ever made. That sounds more like Ringo the Paul.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does.
Coming up this week, that album, those songs, stories about the how, where, and when of those songs by way of paying props to Paul and his peeps, alliteratively speaking. We're going to make the best show we've ever had, even though nobody rang us up and quit. You're not quitting, are you?
No, not today.
There you go. This week, Bluebirds, Jets, and Picasso's Last Words. It's Band on the Run at 50 this week on...
The Audiophiles.
Now, I'm not 100 billion percent sure, because I've never seen it listed on any of the lists of most recognizable music, licks, riffs, etc., like the Bond theme or the Secret Agent Man riff, but I'm pretty sure that would qualify as one of the more recognizable.
It is, yeah. It is recognized, you know. It's not Pretty Woman or anything like that, but it's, no, you recognize it.
But it's Sir Paul who talks like Ringo.
And I told you when I saw Denny Lane with that all-star tribute band, he got to do two songs, and he did Band on the Run and did an admirable job.
Well, it's quite the tune. For those of you who've been living on Uranus, and that's our weekly salute to Dave. Yes, I said Uranus. Band on the Run was the third studio album released by Wings. It was released in November of 73. It was McCartney's fifth album after leaving the Beatles in April of 1970, and sales were actually modest initially. Then it had two hit singles, Jet and the title track Band on the Run. It became the top-selling studio album of 1974 in Britain and Australia, revitalized Mr. McCartney's standing, and at this time remains McCartney's most successful album and the most celebrated of his post-Beatles works. Now, there's your Wikipedia-type summary of what we're talking about. And this year, do the calendar math, it's 50 friggin' years old. So yes, we thought we'd do a little tip of the toupee. Talk a little bit about the music and topping it off or setting it off or getting going with it. You know, around here, we never ever do nothing nice and easy. It always has to be complicated and multi-layered. That's on me. I thought we'd kick off with some stuff, no matter whether you're a Beatle geek or not. It's stuff, duh, we call it Betcha Didn't Knows. In fact, let's call it Band on the Run, Bet You Didn't Knows.
Really?
Whoa!
You bet!
You know it!
Really?
Are you sure?
Yes.
Huh. Well, the rain exploded. All right, Paul McCartney says, first of all, that he wrote the song in response to drug laws that criminalized him and his friends back in the day. Eagles, the Birds. Quote, "We're not criminals. We just would rather do this than hit the booze, which had been a traditional way to do it. We felt this was a better move," unquote. So he's talking about, pretty sure, he's talking about the weed. the pot and getting busted for pot. As far as the heavy stuff, they left that up to David Crosby.
Yeah, and then there's another little twist in there. In 1969, at a Beatles business meeting, George Harrison actually said "Band on the Run," that the Beatles were a band on the run.
Well, I got down in my little later quotes down here. It says apparently maybe during that same meeting, he also supposedly said, because they kept having meeting after meeting after meeting, George Harrison said, "If I ever get out of this house."
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So Paul, creative genius that he was listening to everything everyone was saying and wrote shit down.
Well, actually, you know, John and Paul were always listening to Ringo. You know, with his malapropisms. So it's nice to see, even after they left the Beatles, that George and Ringo were inspiring Paul and John.
That's true. And Paul was always willing to give credit where credit was due.
Right.
Oh, I sure was. Some of this stuff I got from a website that actually talks about stuff you may or may not know about Band on the Run, so don't make it sound like we're coughing up the stuff, and it's, some of it falls into
I purposely didn't go to that site that you gave me because I wanted to be surprised.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's one thing in that I found. I'll get that in a minute. But anyway, the basic idea supposedly about Band on the Run is, wait for it, a kind of prison escape, to which I say, look at the cover. Hello. That's not hard to figure out. At the beginning of the album, the guy is stuck inside these four walls, and then breaks out. Now, McCartney said, it's not a concept album because the songs don't string together a la, say, Sgt. Pepper.
Right.
John Lennon wouldn't have been frustrated and hate it because it was a concept album. But he calls it a thread album. There's a thread.
Yes.
It's just good songs. Doesn't have to have a concept. The song begins in a metaphorical prison. Then the big orchestra blast. This has got to be some idiot music critic who wrote this line. Then the orchestra comes in where McCartney envisioned a hole being blasted in one of the walls and the subsequent escape. Can I just parenthetically jump off the track just a touch for just a second and say this is one of the perfect examples of why I think music critiquing and criticism professionally is useful, useless, and wasteful and just blows.
Mm-hmm.
It's just good songs. If they have a theme, that'll be obvious. And stop trying to turn it into some Jackson Pollock interpretation of a Robert Frost poem on a Norman Rockwell kind of day, please.
And it's going to mean something different to everybody that listens to it.
That's right.
You know, so
it's also going to be good or bad or great or sucks, depending on who you're listening to. Exactly. All subjective. All right. Mr. McCartney mentioned in the little quote there himself at the beginning of the show here. He decided, and this is another thing that I love about this. McCartney asked EMI to send him a list of all the studios they had and found that there was one in Lagos in Nigeria, which, of course, is in Africa. Now, this tickled me, and I know that story anyway because I was around at the inception of the album and all the rest of that. But I think this is kind of charming. This is one of the things about really rich, really famous people that's always tickled me. And you'll see them talk about stuff like this on talk shows and interviews, and it's perfectly natural, and there's nothing particularly, unless they're an asshole or something, there's nothing presumptuous or cocky about it. But it's proof, philosophical proof, of how they really do live in a different universe.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. For sure.
By the nature of what happens.
For sure, yeah.
But you're thinking, you and I, we would be like, hey, listen, you know, we've been doing this podcast now in this particular studio for 5 years now. Let's do something different. Why don't we move this shit over to your house and we'll do it over there?
Now let's go to Africa.
Let's go to Africa. Because why? Because we can.
Yes, yes.
So let's get a map. So anyway, so they go to Lagos, Nigeria. The conception in Paul's mind was that they would lay on the beach in sun all day and then they would
record all night,
night. But what he didn't know, and this is in a pre-internet world, 1970. What he didn't know or didn't bother to find out or nobody told him was that in Nigeria in 1970, they had just come to the end of a civil war. The country was being run by a military government. There was corruption and pestilence and disease everywhere
you turned. Everywhere you turned, yes.
Let's go do an album and lay on the beach. All right. Now, at the very beginning, again, Paul mentions the fact that when they got ready to go, Wings at that time was Paul and Linda and Denny Lane and Denny Seiwell and Henry McCullough.
Right.
Henry and Denny, and the Denny that Paul refers to is Denny Seiwell. Henry McCullough and Denny Seiwell rang up and said, "We're not going. We've had enough." Now, through the years, there have been lots of stories as to why and who did what to who and why they left and et cetera. I found some audio from a couple of interviews and sewed them together real quick. Mr. McCullough and Mr. Seiwell explained themselves exactly what happened and why it happened. Up first, Henry McCullough.
I went into the band not to be a sideman. Once we grasped what we were heading for, then it was heads down. And everybody worked towards that particular goal. And it wasn't for very long, but there was sort of revolution in the air. And Denny Seiwell was starting to feel it a little bit. And all we wanted was to be paid for what we were doing. I didn't want to be on a weekly wage.
Later on in a separate interview, Denny Seiwell weighed in on why he walked away.
I was waiting for some stuff to come along so we'd have some more binding legal agreements before entering into. I knew this record was going to be a big one. And when none of that stuff was being taken care of, I just thought it was time to move on.
Sounds to me like what I'd heard at the inset for a long, long time was that basically Paul considered those guys hired help.
Hired hands, yeah.
And they were on a weekly wage, as Henry McCullough put it.
Now, I think he was treating Denny Lane a little bit different at that
time. For a while.
Yeah.
But still, it was always, Paul was the boss. See, that's part of one of the hidden things about it. And not to besmirch the guy, because I respect him, I admire him.
He's brilliant, yeah.
But there, and it's real. He toes the line. He always has. He's towed the line his entire professional life, and my toupee's off to him because he gets away with it.
Oh yeah,
he's a very positive. When you see him on the interview shows, no matter what, he doesn't ever seem to have a harsh word for anybody. He's not a Pollyanna, but he's you know, right on cheerio. Let's get it done. Good to have you, and all the rest of that. But people that talented don't get as accomplished and as successful at that level with that much talent without being capable of flipping on the asshole switch in New York
and being the taskmaster. And I mean, you know, John and Ringo said as much, you know.
Right.
Paul was the only reason the Beatles got anything done.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's go to Africa.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Well, now, the interesting thing about them going to Africa, you know who was living in Africa at that time?
Who?
Ginger Baker.
No, I just happen to have that written.
Okay,
but
and this is why I'm wondering.
I'll explain to the younger audience who the hell Ginger Baker is.
Ginger Baker is one of the yeah, he passed away. One of the greatest drummers in the history of rock music. He was a founding member of Cream, and he played in a number of different groups. But he settled. He was a big polo player, believe it or not. You know, polo on the horse. And he settled.
As opposed to where?
Water polo in the pool.
Oh, okay. Marco.
Yeah. The funny thing is, he settled in Africa because he was playing with that Feta Kufi.
Gesundheit.
Have you heard of him?
Basically.
He was an African. He was like
the most popular. I enjoyed that on a Ritz cracker, actually.
He was like, he ended up passing away of AIDS, but he was like one of the most popular African artists of that time.
All right.
Our fella Kufi, I think his name was. But anyway, he was playing
there. He's from the Kufi family, yes, is what you're really trying to get down to.
Mr. and Mrs. Kufi had a bunch of kids. So anyway, Ginger Baker was in town, and he did some percussion on
He Band did, on and yeah. I have a little thing for that in a second. It's interesting you say that. But here's the fun part that I loved about this whole thing. When they got there, they found out that the EMI studio in Lagos, Nigeria, was really just for shit. The control panel, the console was crap. What else was there? There was one tape machine. It was an 8-track Studer. And this is the early 70s when things had gone to 16 and 24 track and they were starting to move along. So the band rented houses near the airport. There were two houses. Paul and Linda and the kids stayed in one, and Denny and his wife, JoJo, Jeff Emmerich, the engineer, and the roadies, a couple of roadies they had along with them, also stayed in the other house. Now, this is the fun part. For me, it's the fun part. And one of these stories I knew about, one of them I didn't. And this is like, this is the stuff you learn when you realize and you get to a point. Kids, this is important. You need to know this. There's more stuff on the internet, than porn.
Really?
Yeah. If you go looking.
I got to try that.
You know, unbookmark that Pornhub thing so that it's not the first thing that always pops up and you'll find these things out. They went to Lagos. They were there. They were doing their thing. So one night, Paul and Linda decided, let's take a lovely walk in the starlight and the moonlight. Now, once again, we're talking about Lagos, Nigeria, Africa in the 1970s, just had a civil war, as we mentioned a minute ago.
Military government,
corruption. Can you see where this is going? So they get out and they're walking, and against the advice of their people, okay, they were robbed at knife point. The assailants made off with all their valuables. But now get this. Also, they stole a bag containing a notebook full of handwritten lyrics and songs, cassettes containing demos for the songs to be recorded, pretty much everything they had already done up until that point. And that, the moment I heard that story years ago, the first thing out of my head and mouth, any intelligent person would say, what? Hey,
why are Linda, you carrying that around?
Linda, yeah. Let's go for a lovely romantic walk. Yeah, you grab the parasol. I'll grab the bag full of everything we've accomplished on this trip, including all the lyrics and the cassettes and the recordings, and stroll along the bistro.
Well, isn't that kind of the theme of Give My Regards to Broad Street?
Yes. It doesn't make it any less stupid, but yes, that's exactly what it is. But here's the one I didn't know about. On another occasion, Jeff Emmerich told the story in an interview. McCartney was overdubbing a vocal track, and he started to graphically gasp for air, too. Emmerich said, quote, within seconds, he turned as white as a sheet and then explained to us in his croaking voice he couldn't catch his breath, so we decided to take him outside for some fresh air. It was during the daytime. It was very hot. We took him outside. It was blazing hot. He felt even worse, and he keeled over. He fainted dead away. Linda started screaming, thought he was having a heart attack. The official diagnosis was he had suffered a bronchial spasm brought on by, wait for it, too much smoking. Mm. He was a cigarette smoker. They all were in their early
and
days.
And a pot smoker.
And the pot smoking. And kids, if you haven't imbibed in the ganja, let me explain something to you. Dave and I are not, I don't do any of that stuff anymore because I'm too old.
No, we did when we were young. Yeah.
Sure, but I was never a regular user. I didn't carry. My wife de jure of that period, she had a little leather thing made for her.
With her initials on it?
No.
Oh.
It was actually a very nice dark leather, you know, inscribed with mm-hmm. something. But what it was it was in the shape of a Marlboro hard box, you know, instead of the regular cigarette
packs. Right.
And she rolled 20 joints in the morning and put them in there. She carried it around like a pack of cigarettes, and she would light up. That was a pot smoker.
Right.
Okay. Paul was like that. If you haven't done it with any magnitude, you should know this. Cigarette smoking is not good for you in the first place. Whatever magic things you may get out of smoking pot, and I'm not preaching against it by any measure, the actual smoke itself is harsh.
Yes, yes.
It's a lot rougher than cigarette smoke. And if you're doing it a lot and doing it consciously, your lungs are going, keep fucking with me and I'm going to come back at you.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Well, this is what happened to Paul, but he survived. Now, speaking of the sounds of bronchial spasms, Linda... In her musical way, it's occurred to me through the years, and I'm willing to step up for her, bless her heart. She's been gone a long time now. She took as much shit in the day musically as Yoko took.
When the Beatles were breaking up, yes.
Just for being Yoko. Mm-hmm. Turns out, and Denny Seiwell explained in an interview, Linda was, and this is no pun, she was instrumental not only in Paul's music, but in his life, and was perhaps, you could stretch the point, even responsible for there being any McCartney music at all, after the Fab Four there went belly up.
They were such a couple, the two of them together. It was just totally inseparable, and I'm sure that he just had to have her there. And I believe, from seeing some of this stuff that you've seen in the past years on TV, how he was just hiding away up there at the farm in Scotland when this Beatle breakup and all that stuff was going on, I believe she was the reason that pulled him out of a slump and got him back into activity again, musical activity, writing and appearing live and all that, forming Wings and all that. And he just needed her there.
So maybe he was amazed at the way he loved her all the time.
Well, it could be.
She did. If you listen to the bios and you've seen the various interviews through the years, he was in a deep, dark funk and just decided there was no reason to go on living because, after all he knew how to do was Beatle.
Was be a Beatle,
and
right.
There was no Beatle to mm-hmm. be anymore. So she stepped up and made it happen. So bless her heart. She couldn't sing for shit, but that, you know.
Hey.
Who amongst us, you know?
You're listening to The Audiophiles.
Woo!
I did not Photoshop that.
Well, yeah, I remember that recording.
Now, in her defense, I don't remember where that was recorded, obviously in the 1970s. She was singing back up. They were obviously at some stadium show or something on the stage. This was in the 1970s, a long, long time, not only a pre-internet period.
Well, pre-in-ear monitors.
There were no earbuds. There were no those little things you see all the stars wearing now where they don't have to wear headphones or mic, you know, stuff. Yeah, and they were listening to what was called a floor monitor, which was basically just a speaker in front of them at a mm-hmm. slight angle. It was on the floor.
Faced up at you.
Faced up at you. But you can imagine in a crowd situation with a band playing their asses off. Well, it was hard to hear.
What happened, Scott, with that is, and I did that for many years before I went in here, your ears, after three or four songs, your ears become numb.
Right.
You know, to the sound. So everything's muddied and blurred. It's hard to pick a note out.
And ergo, if you can't hear what you're singing to, especially if it's a harmony of some kind,
right,
then you're going to end up sounding. And even if I've actually experienced what Linda experienced, because I was doing live music myself back in the late 70s and into the early 80s and 90s. And there's plenty of recordings lying around. If somebody got their hand on it, you'd hear me. What tickles me about that particular lick, though, and I noticed it the other day because I haven't listened to it in years. And maybe it's just me. When she's singing it, na 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 na, and then she gets to the "Hey Jude." It reminds me of Shirley Temple when she was singing on the Good Ship Lollipop. It's about purple. It's got that kind of tone to it.
That is too funny.
I think that's cool. All right, watch me stretch the hell out of this segue as I go 6 degrees.
6 degrees of SEP.
Because we're saluting Band on the Run, salute, as it turns 50 years old this year. Back in in the 1970s, 1975, I moved from New Orleans to Nashville and pursued my extremely, excruciatingly successful career as a singer-songwriter for the next 20 years. Here's the anecdote. I was working with, and quickly later married for a brief period of time, a singer-songwriter in Nashville named Kim Morrison, who worked with pretty much all the singers in town. She has quite an illustrious history. She, I understand, I've actually found a, believe it or not, she was a guest on a podcast not too long ago that I stumbled across about a week ago. I haven't talked to her in years, but I listened to her and she was reminding me of some of the stuff she was talking about and people that she knew and things that she had done. She was a talented girl.
I've heard some of the recordings.
Yeah, and she screwed up more deals than you and I would ever have the opportunity to do, because she had one fatal flaw, and I say this not so much talking out of school. The first person I ever heard say this to me was my dear friend Billy Strange, who was a lovely,
right,
mentoring human being.
Member of the Wrecking Crew.
And privately, he told me one time, he goes, "Kim, she's just a superstar talent, and she's fucked up more opportunities than..." Because she had this thing where she couldn't quite, her talent was her talent. She didn't quite have all the other ingredients necessary to make it happen, like take advice to do this or do that. She was almost Trumpish in that sense that I got it, I can do it.
Yeah.
She really couldn't.
I'm the smartest one in the room. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's mm-hmm. happening. But anyway, so short version of this story. She knew everybody and everybody knew her. If you check out her Facebook page, it's right there. She's got like 7,000 friends, and deservedly so, because she's been very well known. And she's a sweetheart, basically. One of the people that she was familiar with or knew when she and I were together was a guy by the name of Rudy McNeely. Now, that name shouldn't ring a bell, because Rudy never really was successful in any great measure. But at the time that I met him, and I only met him, actually physically met him once for like, "Hi, how are you?" But he was kind of Uncle Rudy to Kim's daughter, who, when she and I were together, was 12, 13, 14 years old. Rudy was a singer-songwriter in Nashville. Gee, what a shock. Who was trying to get something going. And he recorded.
What restaurant did he work at?
Yeah, there you go. He recorded an album at one of the three, in those days, premier Nashville recording studios, Sound Shop Studios. Now, this is a quick little thing of what Rudy was up to.
Sing me one more song. Dixie, one more song of cotton fields and hay. Sing me one more song of Dixie.
Yeah, what a thing. It's, you know, it's average, it's okay. Nothing ever came of it. And I, last time I checked, just for fun, I think he's teaching music somewhere in one of the schools or something. And again, nice guy. But he recorded at Sound Shop Studio. Now, here's the where it dovetails into what we've been talking about all along, which is Paul and Linda and Band on the Run. They released Band on the Run in November, I think, of 73. Then they decided to take a little vacation, 1974, and they went to Nashville and spent like a month, I think, or 6 weeks. And they recorded at the, wait for it, Sound Shop Studios, where Rudy McNeely, who knew Kim Morrison, who was married to me, had recorded. And while they were there, they knocked out a few little songs, including this iconic Paul McCartney, a country ditty.
You're my Sally, Sally G. Took the part that was the heart of me.
Sally G. Take it, chaps. Sally G.
Yeah, Sally G.
Did you know any of the session guys on that?
I later had the chance to meet a couple of them. Yeah, and the guy who engineered the session was a wonderful. And when I got to know him, he was already an elder of the recording business. His name was Ernie Winfrey, and he was the guy that engineered those sessions.
Produced
the sessions. Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Of course, her white guy middle aged father. Yeah.
Oprah Winfrey.
What's funny about it, again, and this is almost a walk in between the raindrops kind of thing, too, that song is so blatantly stereotypical of what people think country music yes. sounded like yeah. back in the day.
Well, he was coming from Britain. You know what I mean?
Well, there's that. Yeah. Plus, there are actual photographs. Just if you're interested, it's really fun. You can Google this information, and you'll find I've seen the Polaroids online. The first couple of days anyway, or maybe a week until he figured it out and they made enough fun of him. When he showed up dressed in white blue jeans, a cowboy shirt with the red little flap things on either side,
uh-huh.
the 10-gallon hat, the stereotypical country western. But that's what 90% of the artists in that town didn't look like. People right, don't dress right. like that.
And, well, especially coming from England,
sure.
they only know cowboy. I mean, they probably saw Hank Williams.
Well, the key phrase like is that, country yeah. western. Yeah. It hadn't been called country western music since 1945.
Right, right.
But anyway, Paul and Linda, they were there in Nashville, and I missed it because that was 74, I think, the summer of 74. We moved there in the spring of 75. So later on, I got to know a few of those guys, but it was kind of fun. The original album, Band on the Run, was what we talked about, released in November of 73. Well, sports fans, there's a new album coming. No, not exactly. The latest breaking news on that new album. And you know what? Where we get it? Well, we use our own dependable version of the bat signal and signal too. We just open up the window and we holler out, "Hey, Dave." Hey.
Dave Simmons.
Hey.
Dave.
Hey.
What you got? What's up? Dave.
As we roll it to Dave, it's got what Paul calls is a lick. It's a riff.
Yes,
came up with a riff.
I love that song. The 50th anniversary of Band on the Run is it's going to be released in like several formats. There's going to be a single LP, two LP, two CD formats. The single LP is a special vinyl edition cut at half speed using high resolution transfer of the original master tapes from 73. And it's going to be the US version, which includes Hell and Wheels.
Right.
The two LP will be that. And then there'll be an underdubbed mix. Now, this is what Paul McCartney, this is his exact statement on the website. This is Band on the Run in a way you've never heard before. When you're making a song and putting additional parts like extra guitar, that's an overdub. Well, this version of the album is the opposite, an underdub. So
wasn't that underdog?
Underdog. That, it's kind of a stripped down, almost like when he took all of Phil Spector's stuff off of the Let It Be album.
Let It Be Naked.
Let It Be Naked
is the album.
That's I think what his idea to do with Band on the Run. So that ought to be an interesting. Listen, you know what I mean?
It's archival. There's your $5 word for the day.
Yes, yes. Archival.
But, yeah.
And the two CD format will feature the U.S. album, the underdub mixes, and it will also include a double-sided fold-out Polaroid poster taken by Linda. So
the photographs will be taken by Linda.
Yes,
she didn't steal the poster.
No. That's really...
How much? Did you get a price on that?
I didn't get a price on that.
$63,000.
$63,000. Hold on a second. Let's use tech. Hey, Siri. How much will the new 50th anniversary of Band on the Run cost?
Okay. I found this on the web. For how much will the 50th anniversary Band on the Run cost?
Okay. Well.
Oh, what's it say, Scott?
It does. It gives me just gives me headlines.
Oh, okay.
For websites, which throws it off.
Yeah. Right. So.
Oh, wait. $50.
$50. Okay, that's not too bad.
It's not bad at all.
I thought technology once again failed us.
No. It's fine. $50. I would have thought it was going to be more than that. I might even, I don't know. I'm hedging because I've reached a point in my life where I'm at that place where they talk about the way the life cycle works, the circle game is what you do is you're born, you start to grow up, you start acquiring things, and then it's almost like a curve on a hill. You get to the top, and then you start, as you get older, you start
giving things away,
getting rid of shit, because every time you turn around, there's clutter and stuff. I've got so many of these things, I don't.
You know, in my research of the 50th anniversary, I didn't realize the orchestration on the album was done by Tony Visconti.
Yeah, that rings a bell.
Well, David Bowie's producer,
right,
who was also ended up marrying May Pang,
right,
after John Lennon
had his way
with her.
Thanks to Yoko, who said, hey
you need somebody to sleep with.
See, this is the thing. It was all this whole
incestuous.
Here's the thing. This is an old fogey thing. All the current crap about politicians and nobody, we won't call it anybody in particular, but if you have orange hair and doing all the crap that you do, that's nothing new. It's not like everybody from 10, 20, 50, 100 years ago was Puritans. But you know what? They were classy in their trashiness. There was a classiness to their trashiness. It wasn't just trashy trash. That's the part that bugs me now.
And one of the interesting things about the album, Paul, as for me as a drummer, and we all know, you know, he drummed on Back in the USSR and a couple of the Beatles songs. Paul's a very competent drummer. He when the drummer left, he said, I'll play the drums. Hell with it. So he did the entire album. The odd thing is, the night that Keith Moon died, which I don't know if you know this, September 6, 1978, Moon and his Swedish model girlfriend were guests of Paul and Linda McCartney at the premiere of the Buddy Holly story with Gary Busey.
Wow.
And that's the night Keith Moon died. But they were sitting at a table having a discussion, and Keith Moon's like, "You never told me who played drums on Band on the Run, the song Band on the Run." Paul's like, "That's me." And Keith Moon was like, "Well, is that, that's fucking great. That's fucking great."
That's Keith Moon.
So one of Paul's favorite drummers, Paul listed his three favorite drummers were Ringo, John Bonham, and Keith Moon.
Yep.
Gave Paul his props the night that he died.
And the wheel on the bus
keeps round and round.
There you go.
But yeah, so I found like some of the things intertwining, I found very interesting.
It's interesting. It's also the set looks really good. If you're a collector, you're naturally going to scoff this up. If you're not, and you really are into the early Wing stuff and want to hear him at his way, again, it's going to appeal most to people who have collector's kind. These sets, even at $50, it's a lot of stuff to be listening to. And when you listen to eight different versions of Band on the Run, it's even similar to anthology, the Beatles anthology records. If you and no, recordings, if you,
what's the release date? Like February 2nd or something? Or
2nd or 4th? Don't they release new things still on Tuesdays, or have they changed that?
I don't know off the top of my head.
One of my retail lives, I was aware of that kind of stuff, but I'm not right.
Well, that's when you were working at the big store.
I was co-managing Tower Records in Nashville, where Bonnie Raitt stopped by one day and said hello. Speaking of Ginger Baker,
in a white room with black curtains, near the station.
Dave Simmons, Scott Edward Phelps, The Audiophiles.
All right, so at some point, you might or might not have been asking yourself, well, what does Ginger Baker have to do with the thing? Well, we already told you that, but in case you're just tuning in, and once again, we ask this each week, if you're just tuning in, why the hell did you tune into the podcast halfway through? What are you thinking about?
It's not live.
Well, it may not be live, but it certainly goes from beginning to end. Here's something I didn't know, and you mentioned this, about Ginger Baker being there when Wings was there in 1973 for that little summer gig they did. But Ginger Baker owned a studio in Ikeja, Lagos, Nigeria, called ARC, A-R-C. Something magical must have been going on in Lagos, Nigeria, because Ginger Baker, of all people, owning a recording studio, just like, you know what I'm saying? So anyway, that's neither here nor there. He invited Wings, the Entourage, to come on over, and he told Paul, he said, you can do the whole album here if you want to. Maybe when they started talking about how crappy the EMI studio was. McCartney agreed, though, to just a single day, and they recorded one song. And as you mentioned, Ginger Baker himself played the shaker, but it was a homemade shaker, a tin can filled with gravel that they made on the spot. See, those are the good old days. Speaking of that, and this has nothing to do with Wings, you may or may not know this, but I learned this in Nashville doing recording work, demo work back in the 1970s. Before there was sampling, before there was software, you could computer, you could bring anything in sound effect wise. And I think it was earlier mentioned singer-songwriter Kim Morrison who taught me this. We were doing a song, and one of our own songs, and we were in a full-blown studio with players and all. And it was a that thing you do kind of feel, and we wanted a...
The hand clap, yeah.
Okay. So we get ready to record a hand clap, and I said to Kim, how many people we need to do this? And she said, well, we need four. I said, four people to get the sound? She goes, well, yeah. And then they started rearranging chairs, and I'm like, what are you doing? We need to get around the mic. She says, no, just do what we tell you. Okay, fine, because I didn't know any better. The engineer was a very experienced young guy who said, yeah, this is really a whole lot better. What they had us do was they had us sit. They placed four folding chairs so that we were facing each other with the microphone on the boom down, brought down so that it was between the four of us.
Right.
Then we took, and it has to be glossy. You take a glossy magazine. In this case, we use Billboard magazine. Open it up, put it on your lap, and instead of slapping your hands, you slapped the magazine on your thighs.
So that gave you eight.
But the thing of it is, and we had time to kill, so they proved it to me because I was like, this is cool, but are you sure? I'm interested how this works. And it was the sonic sound of whatever it does. The sound of four people slapping their thighs on a glossy magazine sounds more like the sound of four people clapping their hands than does the sound of four people clapping their hands.
Yes.
There's some trivia for you. So if you get into a thing with that.
Well, when you're just starting out in recording, and we have a recording studio, and I remember we wanted the megaphone, like the old 20s megaphone.
Sure, Rudy Vell.
So what we ended up doing is we ended up hanging a pair of headphones over a microphone.
Right, yeah.
And that we got the same effect as a megaphone. So there was like tons of little tricks to get effect.
Well, necessity is the mother of invention. Back in those days, there weren't
plug-ins on your computer, yeah.
Here's another little quickie. It has nothing to do with Band on the Run, but next time you hear it, you'll go, hey, I didn't know that until now, and I heard that in audio files talking about it. Next time you hear the Bee Gees song, Tragedy. 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 Around the midway, it comes out of the chorus, and there's the sound of an explosion. Okay? Tragedy. Now, this was the 1970s. They didn't have software. They didn't have special effects. What you're hearing, when you hear it the next time, you'll go, I'll be damned. Barry Gibb, Morris Gibb, Robin Gibb, standing around a microphone, they cranked up the reverb, and it was all three of them, and they triple-tracked it, going like this. Yeah. Like we used to do when we were kids to make the sound of an explosion. Because you do what you got to do with what you get.
Yeah. And those, I tell you what, those Stayin' Alive sessions, Stayin' Alive is one of the first drum loops, if not the first drum loop.
Yeah. And and the technology's fine, but it kind of takes away a little bit. We've been in the AI debate already, how it kind of dehumanizes it a little bit and then a lot of it. All right. So back to the song. They recorded it in Ginger Baker's studio. Ginger was shaking the can on the gravel. And as for the song, well, son of a gun, wouldn't you know it, there's a story.
Here's a story.
All right, the song from Band on the Run originated when Paul and Linda and Entourage, they were having a little vacation in Jamaica. They decided to enjoy the Caribbean Ocean without having to be threatened with rioting, government,
post-Civil War rioting.
And they were having dinner with actor Dustin Hoffman. Remember Dustin Hoffman from Rain Man and assorted other films? He was there in the 70s filming a movie called Papillon.
I'm a good driver.
Which was Walmart sucks. Wapner, for Wapner.
Steve McQueen, right?
Yes, Steve McQueen. Mm-hmm. And you know who else was in that movie? As in a bit part? on the ship as the slave ship was being taken wherever, and he was just a teenager, a young teenager, then coming out of his childhood successes and before he went into other things, Bill Mumy.
Oh, Bill! Oh, Billy!
He has about 6 minutes of screen time in Papillon,
and a friend of the show.
There you go. And by the way, it's spelled like it's Papillon, but trust us, it's Papillon. Okay,
Papillon.
Show a little culture. So anyway, Dustin Hoffman and his wife, Paul Linda, they're having dinner, and they got talking, and a little ganja, I'm sure, some wine flowing. Paul said that he was telling Dustin that, I think Dustin was inquiring about being a songwriter because Dustin Hoffman was an actor and didn't feel like he had any musical abilities, and he was enamored of Paul's work. And Paul said, it's just what I do. He said he could write a song about anything. So Dustin, probably a little wind up, challenged him to write something on the spot. Looked around, saw a magazine, picked it up, handed it to him, opened it up, and the article that he happened to open it up to was an article about the iconic Pablo Picasso, the artist, his death. And Paul sat there and looked at the article, and in the article it quoted what were supposedly Pablo Picasso's last words. Paul started kind of humming to himself, did a little melody to go along with it, and he sang, much to Dustin Hoffman's astonishment, this song, which became a full-blown song, on Band on the Run.
So drink to me, drink to my health. You know I can't drink anymore. Drink to me, drink to my health. You know I can't drink anymore.
You know, what's kind of endearing to me as I was editing that excerpt and having listened to that song for a while, it occurs to me, again, this is 1973 when Band on the Run was recorded and released. That song right there, I think for my money alone on any of the other songs on the album, is a moment of Beatle nostalgia where Paul McCartney's Sergeant Pepper started to kind of creep back into the thing because that horn thing, right?
Has
a little bit of a Sergeant Pepper-ish kind of, it could go there if they were, and you know, because that's what they did. But so he impressed the shit out of Dustin Hoffman, and then, you know.
Nice.
And of course, Paul McCartney.
I did not know that story.
One of America's great actors, and of course, give my regards to Broad Street. Don't blame us when you see this. All right. If one picture is worth 1,000 words, the picture we're going to chat about for a minute is probably second only to the picture on Sergeant Pepper for sheer recognizability. But for fun facts to know and tell about the iconic Band on the Run album cover, we reopen that window, and once again, we yell out, "Hey, Dave.
Why don't you take a picture? It'll last longer."
What was Streisand's 8th album?
Shut up.
Everybody freeze.
Picture time.
Dave Simmons, The Audiophiles.
It is an iconic cover. It's not particularly complicated, but it's cute.
No, I think it's interesting because the thing that always stood out for me is I'm a big, and you know this, I'm a big fan of Westerns.
Yep.
You know, I don't care if it's a B Western or a spaghetti Western or, you know, a full blown John Wayne
or a country Western,
extravagant. Yeah. I'm talking about the movies, not the music. The first thing that jumped off of that cover to me was James Coburn.
Right.
You know, a great Western actor. He was in a ton of spaghetti Westerns and movies. And,
although his main claim to fame, as an actor. In those days.
Oh, Flint? My man Flint?
Our man Flint.
Yeah.
Which was a James Bond parody back in the day.
Yeah. And what was the Dean Martin one?
The Silencers? Well, he was Matt Helm. Dean Martin was Matt Helm, but I don't know about. By the way, speaking of Westerns, and not to throw you off the track.
Sure.
The very first time I ever saw James Coburn as an actor, I think, was probably in the late 1950s. He did a lot of TV.
Yes.
Wagon Train, mm-hmm. Have Gun Will Travel, and even non-Western stuff. But the first time I ever
really. He did Gunsmoke, too.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, everybody. Gunsmoke was like, you know, Real
Housewives.
Laugh it. It's like everybody laugh does.
Everybody,
it,
yeah.
The very first time that I recall, and I would have been, let's see, carry the one, I would have been 9 years old. He was one of the, and this is the original movie, not any cheesy remake or sequel, he was one of the original The Magnificent Seven.
Yes. Yes, he was.
He was the one with the ability to take the knife and throw it across and stab you right in the gut. So anyway, Coburn's on the cover. And
Coburn's on the cover. There's several people on the cover. And
How did that come about, by the way?
I have no clue.
He happened to be in town.
Ah.
And McCartney knew he was in town, and McCartney liked his acting and was a James Coburn fan. And just on one of those, let's pick up the phone and see if he wants to be on my album
cover. Yeah, there was a handful of extras, so to speak, some of them famous, some of them not.
Well, you know what it is today? Actually, here's the equivalent of what the Band on the Run cover is for us here over in Merca. One of my favorite television shows, and in my opinion, the best of the late night style shows. I like Colbert, okay. I've never much cared for Fallon. We don't want to get too far off the track. I love the Graham Norton show.
Mm-hmm.
BBC America, if you're not hip to it. This guy has been around. He's been on the air for like 25 or 30 years.
And he's hysterical.
He's hilarious. And it's just good, sharp conversation. It's a big couch. And he brings everybody out at once. They don't feed him out one at a time like the old.
And they give him alcohol.
And they drink a little bit. So they have some wonderful conversation. But I'll tell you what it is. It's like the Band on the Run cover to the is to music, popular music, what the Graham Norton show is to television. My wife and I like to watch the Graham Norton show, but we'll scan the cast list and the little synopsis before we decide to watch or not watch, because there are sometimes shows where, for example, the cast and all sitting on the one couch talking to Graham. You got, I remember seeing one not too long ago, Robert De Niro, Julia Roberts, Dame Judi Dench, and then some musical performer and Graham. That's a spectacular guest list. Other times, and this especially was true during the COVID period, they're very much British performers or stars or actors or whatever the case may be. And we may not be familiar with them because they're not necessarily big stars. The Band on the Run cover is iconic, and everybody in Britain knows exactly who all those people are, whereas we don't know who half of them, to this day, unless I go to a thing that's got a list of who they are and what they did. But like British comic, British essayist and all.
So that's So it's James Coburn is the one that everybody in America would know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's iconic with the prison wall, with the spotlight. It's just, it's an album cover that if you're walking through a music store and that's at the front of the record, you stop because you look at it. And you're
know, the other part of it is, and maybe your thing didn't have it, and I didn't know this either. If you look at the album, I wish we could show you the picture, but just Google a picture and go back and mark the podcast here and then come back and listen to us talking while you're looking at the picture. It's got, they're up against a brick wall in what everything is dark and a single spotlight is on them. The spotlight has kind of a yellowish sort of
hue to
spotlightish hue. That was an accident.
It was?
The photographer screwed up and didn't put the right filter on for what he was supposed to be doing and took all these pictures and got it all done. And then the people all went their various ways. And he realized, oh, my God, and he took the best of what he had of availability of the poses and everything, and he showed them and kind of leaned it in McCartney's direction. And McCartney went, I love that. Let's use that one. And the photographer told an anecdote years later in an interview that said many years later, he had the occasion to be at some kind of banquet or something and had a reunion, hello, how are you, with Paul McCartney, and said, I want to tell you something I've never told you before. He said, I fucked up on the photography for that cover that day, and it was the wrong filter. And Paul goes, well, I loved it, so, you know, good for you.
Right, right. So, that's too funny.
Accidents happen.
Yeah.
So that's what my mom said all the time.
It's hard to believe that you could ever doubt me.
Scott Edward Phelps, Dave Simmons, The Audiophiles.
I can tell by the look in your eyes, you're a little surprised. You didn't know what that was. Happy surprise. What does a Monkees track from Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, Jones, and Schwartz Limited have to do with Band on the Run? Well, you just hang in there, little buckaroos. We're going to cover that momentito. But first up, we're going to cover covers.
What the hell is going on?
All right, first of all, let's get it clear. That is not Dave's middle school days garage band. Secondly, it is not the encore number from those kids who knocked Come Home from West Virginia out of the park.
It'll only be a while, and you come home to West Virginia.
this year, by the way, celebrating 37 years as not being the West Virginia State song. What that is that's the Langley School Project from a 1976 album entitled Glenwood Region Music Group. And we offer it up as proof positive that the idea that anybody and everybody can cover songs by hit artists is not always necessarily a good thing. Case in point.
True.
With that in mind, put together a little medley of Band on the Run knots that have appeared through the years. In other words, covers of the songs in the order in which they appear on the album. Starting off with...
covered only a half dozen or so times, probably because of its construction, the title track, a little out of the comfort zone of 60s folk pop legend, Richie Havens.
If I ever get out of here,
track two, Bluebird, sung sweetly or tweetly by one of Dave's faves, Corinne Bailey Ray.
Late at night when the wind is still, I'm come through your door, and you'll know what love is for. I'm a bluebird. Yeah, yeah.
The unusually titled Mrs. Vanderbilt, another of your not covered nearly as much as like yesterday. This version by a group previously known as Los Buques is a Mexican guapera music band from Barrio de Rosales, Michoacana, and I have absolutely no idea how many of those words I pronounced correctly. I do have the band's current name, mucho gusto though, Los Mismos. The fifth and last track on side one, a kick and kicker covered a dozen or so times, Richie Sambora, for a tribute album to the guy who sat in on guitar with Richie Sambora, a guy who was turning 90 with the release of that tribute album, Les Paul.
I honestly don't know how much Les Paul is playing on that particular track, but it's
charming. I don't even know if he's awake.
Well, it doesn't matter. The man was 90 years old at the time, and that was charming as all giddy up. And by the way, a little post note, the Richie Havens recording of Band on the Run, you heard just a little sliver of that right there.
Mm-hmm.
But believe it or not, you heard pretty much the whole deal. That's what he does for 4.5 minutes.
Oh, wow.
As he sings, If I Ever Get Out of Here.
Now, as a note, I love Richie Havens' voice.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, when he did Freedom at Woodstock, that was just amazing.
He's one of those, we talk about this all the time, the business of individuality and genuine singing uniqueness is when you hear somebody's voice, you go, oh, that's, and it's not anybody else.
Right.
It doesn't sound like, if I hear Drake or Frake or Break, I don't know whether it's Frake or Break or Drake, and that's the old folk.
That's
thing.
True.
All right, flip the album over, and the first track on side two, well, it was a little ditty called Mamunia. Now, if you're just joining us, the title of the song is Mamunia. And the reason I played that cut is because I did my little homework. I could only find two circumstances where that song was covered. Again, it ain't yesterday, so it's not going to have thousands of recordings. But also, this is a thing as a songwriter, and Dave's a songwriter, going to appreciate this too. Songwriting lyrics, unless they're like Nashville old school country telling a story or a story saga type song, they generally don't work. Sometimes they even suck on paper. But there's a magic in the way they're combined with the music to create mm-hmm. a song, and they feel perfectly natural. Well, let me give you an example. Paul McCartney wrote this song. We're talking about Sir Paul McCartney, who wrote Eleanor Rigby, who wrote Yesterday, who wrote, this is the lyric, one little chunk of the lyric. Mamunia, 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 oh-oh-oh. Mamunia, mamunia, oh-oh-oh. Mamunia, 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 oh-oh-oh. The rain comes falling from the sky to fill the stream that fills the sea, and that's where life began for you and me. So next time you see rain, it ain't bad. Don't complain, it rains for you. Mamunia, 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 oh-oh-oh.
All the single ladies, all the single ladies.
And remember, and I say this often in jest, and I say it with respect, this is a man who wrote Yesterday and Eleanor mm-hmm. Rigby and all those great songs. He also wrote, whoa, 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 my love does it good.
Yes.
All right, now, quickie for you. That cut, that cover, was by a lady named Teresa Cowles. I'd never heard of her. I just heard the cut, and I went, okay, and then I did a little research. She's a bass player, works out of L.A. She's probably a little older now and doesn't do a lot of stuff. But here's a fun trivia, and it reverts back to and dovetails into the Monkey song that I played a minute ago.
Oh, really?
All right, hard to believe, singing David mm-hmm. Jones singing it from Pisces Aquarius. Teresa Cowles is a bass player out of L.A. Have you ever seen, of course you have, the John Cusack starring Brian Wilson biopic Love and Mercy?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And by the way, unintentionally, during the run-through this morning, I stumbled over my words, and I called it a bryopic.
A bryopic.
And I thought, well, that's wrong. But I thought, wait a minute, a Brian Wilson biographical pic would be a bryopic.
That would be a bryopic.
It's a great movie. In that movie, as it portrays many periods of Brian Wilson's life, including the period where he was doing the peak recordings of the Beach Boys and working with the Wrecking Crew, Teresa Cowles played Carol Kay in the movies Love and Mercy.
I didn't know that.
There you go. And she did a cover of that song. The next song on the Band on the Run album, I could only find one cover of it. Another friend of the show, Carol Kay. I could only find one cover of the song, No Words. And the recording, well, it's an Australian guy named Josh Goodman.
You wanna give your love.
He's got that, not in a good way, but he's got that nasally Randy Newman delivery.
It sounds like Randy Newman meets Neil Innes from the Ruggles,
yes.
meets a little Al Stewart, but yeah. he's slightly off pitch,
uh-huh.
and it sounds like he's using a Casio. Anyway, nice work there, Josh. By the way, Denny Lane co-wrote No Words. Denny Lane also co-wrote the Smash Wings hit, Mull of Kintyre. Other than that, Denny Lane's contribution was whatever it was during
right.
the time they were together, and they were together. He says, about No Words, the song that Josh did there. Denny Lane says, the only song I wrote was No Words that ended up being a dual composition because No Words was a two songs that were put together. It was Paul's idea to put two of my songs together. Does A Day in the Life ring a bell?
Yeah.
Yeah, same concept. Again, later on, he enjoyed a big commercial success with McCartney. Then the song, and here's a little fun thing, speaking of. We talked about the Dustin Hoffman thing and how McCartney wrote Picasso's last words after being dared by Dustin Hoffman to write a song on the spot. It's been covered half a dozen times, and most of these kinds of things, when I say covered, this also includes things like Top of the Pops Orchestra and stuff like
right,
that
right.
do these songs. But I stumbled across this, and I thought, you know what? I'm not going to put Dave on the spot by doing the intro and making a big segment out of it, but just for fun, here's a little baby version of Hey Dave, Guess Who?
A grand old painter died last night. His painting's on the wall. Before he went, he bade us well and said good night to us all. A drink to me, drink to my health. You know I can't drink anymore. Drink to me, drink to my health. You know I can't drink anymore. Oh.
Okay,
got any idea.
I got no. It, when he first started singing, it sounded a little bit like Graham Nash, but I didn't.
And I thought Cat Stevens. It's got a little Cat Stevens. Nah, in the very beginning, there's some vocal inflections that I heard a little Cat Stevens. No,
who is that?
That's Denny Lane.
Oh, wow.
Who did it for some little project he was working on a few years ago. We talked about Denny a few weeks ago. He passed away, what, 4 or 5 weeks
ago? Yeah, we did a whole segment on him.
At the end. Oh, yeah, that's where I heard it.
Yeah, okay.
He was 79 years young.
He was great. When I saw him live, and it's been within the last 2 years that I've seen him live, so...
Well, you won't be seeing him live anymore.
No, we won't.
As far as we know. But then there's always AI, so hey, there's that. Paul and Denny were kind of a duo there for a little while, but you know, in an interview some years later, Paul was asked, hey, Denny Lane, you don't work with you anymore, but you guys are real good buds, aren't you?
Denny Lane, no, we're not big friends. We had a bit of a fallout, and he sold his story to the newspapers, which is never going to make a great friend of those kind of people, you know. He says he was drunk when he did it and stuff, and he probably was. But he's okay, but we don't see much of each other, you know.
See, once again, the Paul McCartney.
You're dead to me.
That's right.
Spit on me once, I'm wet forever.
That's right. Fredo, you went against the family. So I want 2 days' notice when you're going to visit our mother, and that's all there is to that.
I don't want anything to happen to Denny as long as our mother's alive.
All right, as we mentioned at the outset, there were two and only two hit singles from the album. The title track song there, Your Band on the Run, that you've heard many times along the way, including this episode. And we promise you, though, as far as the other single success is concerned, you have never heard it. Taking off and flying high like you're about to hear it, believe it or not, Jet by the London Symphony Orchestra. I got to tell you, I was so inspired by that I have taken and I have cut a version. I have taken a demo version of Come Home to West Virginia, and I'm shipping it off to the London Symphony Orchestra in hopes that they will do an instrumental version of that. If they bite, I will be the first one to tell you what's going on.
That is awesome.
I think it's a perfect time to start wrapping it up.
And now, the moment you've all been waiting for.
So glad we had this time together.
Oh, that is so lame.
Just so the rest of us know how much time is left.
Can you move it out of here?
Okay, wrap it up, kid.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The audio files.
All right, it's that time of the year and that time of the show and that time of the day when Dave gets a chance to express deep gratitude to all the people who are lining his pockets and making him a rich man in his old age.
Well, you know how that goes.
Yeah, I do, as a matter of fact.
I'd like to thank my sponsors, my list of sponsors. It seems to get longer every week. Trinity Cymbals.
At your age, Robbie, that's an advantage.
Robbie and Lynn, thank you so much for everything you do. H&H Drums. H&H. HHG Drums.
Speaking of old days.
Yeah, Sam and Kevin, you guys are awesome. Iowa, hello Indonesia, our Indonesian fan base over there. Solo Beat Drumsticks, you can buy the signature 5A Dave Simmons drumsticks at, Earl Teat Music, both locations, Dover, Delaware and Delmar, Delaware.
Just can't seem to get a hold of it, can you?
Yeah. Nia Cox from Access Energy Drinks. Thank you for everything you do for me. I really appreciate all my sponsors. This Saturday, I will be appearing at the Richmond Drum Show in Richmond, Virginia. I'll be in the Trinity Cymbals booth with Bernard Purdy and Robbie Rodriguez, who is the owner of Trinity Cymbals, another friend of the show. And the 27th, we have a sold-out Ultimate Diamond show at The Room at Cedar Grove in Lewis, Delaware. So that's all I got going on. What do you got going on, Scott?
Right after the show, I'm going to the microwave and heat up a Hot Pocket.
Tell them about your podcast.
Well, gosh, 45 RPM with Scott Edward Phelps, and it's an oldies program unlike any oldies program. You can find it in the same place you find our program here. And by the way, we've managed to get through the whole show without mentioning, and especially this week, Because of the wonderfulness and eclectic nature of everything we've shared with you, our sister companion podcast, The Audio Files, is going to be up and running later today and ad infinitum with full versions of the songs that you've heard along the way here today. And by the way, I'm working on, and I decided, I was debating whether to do it one way or another, and I decided on the other. That's an old routine. Homer and Jethro were a comedy duo back in the 1950s. They were kind of the Smothers Brothers meets Cornpone, but they were pretty funny. And they used to come out and they would do their opening number. And then their opening shtick was, thank you very much. Well, you know, we only do two songs and we always do one of them first. Which one do you want to do now? Let's do the other one. That's how I came to this. I thought about making it into an audio book, and there's not a lot of difference in what I'm doing, but I am actually in the process. I'm in pre-production of turning my, critically acclaimed self-written autobiographical memoir into a, I think it's either going to be 6 or 8 episode podcast of I've Never Heard of You Either.
Oh, okay.
With music accompaniment and me narrating and kind of a cross between a podcast and an audiobook. That'll be available later this year. We'll let you know what's going on.
That's a very good book. You have led an interesting life, Scott.
I have thus far. And this particular podcast will be the one place where you can share this material and I can share this material with you. And I'm pretty much guaranteed that I don't have to listen to any shit from Dave about there not being any pictures because it's a podcast. But there's that. Nevertheless, that's what we're up to.
You got anything else, Scott?
Let's just wrap it up this way. The final track on Band on the Run has, as far as I could find this past week, been covered, if you want to call it that, 2 times. One by a group called The Golden Dogs. They did a cover version on their 2006 album, Big Eye, Little Eye. I have no idea who they are. I'm sure they're wonderful people. In 2016, a German producer named Timo Maas and a Canadian DJ named James Tease released a remix of the original track with Paul McCartney's awareness and approval, and they got a Grammy nomination for Best Remixed Recording with Paul McCartney's approval. They didn't win the Grammy, but what the hell? It's an honor just to be nominated.
Yes, it is.
All right, neither one of the covers being anything to write home about, we thought sometimes ain't nothing like the real thing. So we're going to leave you with a bit of that final song, the original version of that song, That's It by Cracky. By golly, the guy went from Will You Still Need Me When I'm 64 to No One Left Alive in 1985. I'm Scott Edward Phelps.
I'm Dave Simmons.
And we are the Audiophiles.
The Audio Files is produced in the United States of America. Questions, comments, and witty banter welcome. AudioFilesBroadcast@gmail.com. The Audio Files.
Hello, everybody. This is George Harrison. Happy New Year. Drive safely.